Hello, I'm Matt Mayton, Deputy Editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our Editor-at-Large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
And our contributor, Leila Latif.
Hi.
This week, we're rating Ryan Reynolds' Free Guy, Sundance winner Coda, Mexican dystopia New Order, and Benedict Cumberbatch's The Courier. But before we start reviewing those, what have you guys been watching this week?
I've gone on a massive Elin's comedy binge. Basically, I saw them all like years and years and years ago when I was at university, but now I hate to admit that was too many years ago, probably 25 years ago. So it's almost like watching them for the first time that I have vague memories of them all, obviously. But I've watched Whiskey Galore, Titfield Thunderbolt, Hue and Cry, Man in the White Suit, Passport to Pimlico, The Maggie, which is one of the lesser known ones, but it's very, very good, by Alexander McKendrick. So I've just been rewatching them all and having a whale of a time with it. You know, they really understand that peculiar thing of what it is to be British. And watching them now, it's just amazing how much booze plays a part in them. Just all the characters are constantly on the piss. They're just like, it's quite incredible. So I've been watching those and I still got a couple of biggies to go. I've saved Kind Hearts and Coronets and The Lady Killers and The Lavender Hill Mob to the end because I wanted to go out big.
What inspired that revisit?
I don't know. I just fancied it. I do these mini seasons for myself almost to amuse myself where I suddenly go, right, I'm going to watch all the Coen Brothers films in like chronological order. Or I'm going to watch every Tom Cruise movie or something. You know, I just suddenly have a mini season, Robert Altman or something. And I just suddenly thought, you know what? I haven't seen the Elin comedies for 20 years. I'm going to have a go at them. And I'm very glad I did.
And Leila, what have you been watching this week?
I finally have now watched every David Lynch film because I watched Dune and that was the only one I hadn't seen. But I kind of was doing, trying to kind of do my background because I'll be writing about it at the Venice Film Festival in a couple of weeks. It's kind of interesting. I watched that. I watched a really bad miniseries with James McAvoy, which was a sequel to it, which is kind of fun because it was
so
rubbish. But like in quite a kind of Stargate Atlantis kind of way. I've been doing that. And then I've also been watching a lot of like Middle Eastern and Arab cinema because I'm writing about a BFI season that's coming up, all based around this cool new Egyptian film called Suad. Quite the contrast. Nice. Actually quite a lot of Middle East in Dune as well. So maybe it's actually more thematically connected than I thought.
How about you, Matt? What have you been watching?
Well, I don't know if you guys have watched this as well, but I got access to the first three episodes of Marvel's What If, the new animated series for Disney Plus. The first one is out now, so you can see the first one on Disney Plus. But yeah, I've seen the second two as well, which is sort of, it's always a bit of a mixed blessing because in a very first world problem, I now have to wait like 3 weeks to see a new one because I've just kind of gorged on these three they gave. But I enjoyed it quite a lot, actually. I was looking forward to it anyway. Just this kind of concept of, you know, just like, I mean, it's always a fascinating concept, isn't it? The sort of what if one thing was slightly different. And it starts off with the Captain Carter episode. That's the first one that you can watch now, where Peggy Carter ends up getting the super soldier serum instead of Steve. And we sort of see how that plays out. Of the three that I saw, the second was the best, which is the T'Challa one, where T'Challa becomes Star-Lord instead of Peter Quill. He gets picked up by the Ravagers. And one, it was just really nice, obviously, because you just get a little bit extra Chadwick Boseman does the voice again in the series. And I really enjoyed that one. And we see what the world would be like if Star-Lord, you know, was more sort of honourable, decent guy. So that was interesting. And then the third one, I won't say too much about, but it sort of has this kind of murder mystery element to it and features a lot of the big characters. So that was interesting as well. So, yeah, I've enjoyed that and roll on the rest of them.
That second talking. Episode sounds great.
Because yeah,
most sound great. I was just going to say, talking of Disney Plus and animations, I've been watching that Monsters at Work as well. I've been quite disappointed with, really, to be honest. But
I was quite disappointed by the first episode. I haven't actually got round to watching more since due to that slight disappointment, but I will finish it one day.
They're perfectly diverting. You know, it's good fun, but they're just not a patch on, you know, Monsters Inc., which is one of the best Pixar films, obviously.
One of the things I was also doing this week was for another place I write for. We're kind of doing a piece on the best films of 2001. And I'm now convinced that 2001 was the greatest year of films in my
Are you?
lifetime, bar none. Yeah, it's just such a good year. And Monsters, Inc. was one of the ones I rewatched for that. And if you watch it on Disney Plus, you don't have the blooper reel in the credits or the put that thing back where you found it also helped me the musical.
Really?
And I was furious. Like, I had to find that on YouTube just to make sure I hadn't hallucinated it. But yeah, no, it's
That's
not on the Disney
outrageous.
Plus one. Crazy.
That's terrible. I can't believe you're saying 2001 is the best year for movies, though, in your lifetime.
Yeah.
Better than 1999.
Yes.
That is the
I will.
year. Magnolia, Matrix.
I see that
There's
and
loads
I
more I can't
raise
remember now, but.
you. Mulholland Drive, In the Mood for Love, Memento, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, not bad. Blair Witch Project, 1990. Let's just go back and forth, but yeah.
Hedwig and the Angry Inch. I mean,
Yeah,
like, need I
that's
say
good.
more?
Election, 1999. These are just off the top of my head, but yeah, no, they're two great years. Yeah, we agree to disagree.
All right, so back to 2021 then. Let's start with our first new review of the week. So let's get in the game with this.
Mondays, am I right, Joe?
You said it, guy.
Yeah. Don't have a good day. Have a great day.
Everybody down on the ground!
Hey, bud, you ever think that there's got to be more?
More than what?
The stuff we do day after day. Being shot at? Run over? Taken hostage?
Everybody down on the ground!
Today's gonna be different.
That was Free Guy, of course. Layla, could you set up Free Guy for us, please?
Yeah, so Free Guy is about a guy called Guy, who is a bank teller who discovers that he's a non-player character within a kind of shooter video game. So there's a load of people in it who have sunglasses on, and they are actually players from the outside world, kind of doing something. I think a bit like a Grand Theft Auto. I don't really play video games, and so but I'm sure this will be riddled with inaccuracies. Yeah, and but he's one of those background characters, one of those kind of like cannon fodder people, and he works in a bank which kind of gets held up every 15 minutes by some players coming in to kind of live out their bank robber fantasies. But he manages to get a pair of the sunglasses, and he almost becomes sentient, and he becomes aware of the video game world and is able to kind of exist in it just like one of the actual character players. There is also a subplot, which is kind of the programmers and the video game company on the outside and them dealing with a player becoming sentient. So for me, it was very like two halves. Like, I thought all of the stuff in the video game with Ryan Reynolds doing his action comedy thing with his best mate, Lil Rel, who's called Buddy because of course he is. Yeah, and all of their stuff was really good fun, and I think a lot of the jokes landed and the absurdity landed, and it was certainly a big improvement from the Hitman's Wife Bodyguard. But all of the stuff in the real world I actually found really boring, and like I just could not get invested in like, oh, this programmer has a lawsuit against this one, and how will that work out, and all of that stuff. So every time we kind of cut away from Ryan Reynolds and Lil Rel, I just had a kind of, oh, sad moment. And I would also say that even the real world characters are like actually competently acted, but I think Taika Waititi as Antoine, who's like the CEO of the company that owns this video game, is like actively terrible in this, and like so. And I think that maybe he's one of those people, a bit like a Woody Allen or a Quentin Tarantino, where he only makes sense if he's doing his own dialogue. So I also thought he was pretty bad in the Suicide Squad recently. He was distracting for me, but I still think that overall it was a pretty fun film. I had a good time.
What did you think, Jamie?
Yeah, I kind of agree with Layla that all of the stuff in the game I enjoyed, that I thought the special effects were good and fun, and the action, was really dynamic. And Ryan Reynolds is kind of doing his usual Ryan Reynolds shtick, where he's very sort of, wise guy, smart mouth, and he does it very, very well. Although I am getting to the point now where I'm getting a little bit bored of it, because he's done it, six or seven movies now, but he is good at it. And I thought Jodie Comer is, I mean, we know this anyway from Killing Eve, but this kind of confirmed to me that she's a massive star in the waiting. You know, I thought she was great at the action. You know, she really lives with Ryan Reynolds. Everything he sort of throws at her, she bounces back with interest. You know, I thought she was really, really great. So all of that side, I enjoyed the stuff in the real world, which kind of had to be there to stabilize the film and, you know, make sense of it. But it's just not as interesting. And they go back to the real world a lot. I would have liked that to be there because it kind of has to be, but maybe not as much. Maybe, you know, every now and then you just cut back to get a sense of it. But the film's almost divided 50-50 between them. And I think that was maybe a mistake.
Yeah, it's hard to get a balance. Like, overall, I also felt similarly to you guys. I had sort of mixed feelings, but there was something warm about it that I kind of liked and felt sort of, you know, fitting for now, that the sort of thing, you know, there was something kind of good-hearted about it. And it was one of those things, like a few quibbles I had. I agree with Layla in that I'm typically a big fan of Taika Waititi, but I just didn't really think he worked here. Again, yeah, I don't know if it was because he was too on script or whatever it was. And I guess the character was just quite flatly sort of written anyway, just this kind of grumpy CEO type character. You know, it was pretty one note. He didn't really work for me in the film. And it was strange because they've made such a big deal out of it being an original, you know, and it is kind of, you know, a huge budget film that's not based on existing IP or whatever. But then there is quite a cynical sort of crossover moment late on in the film, which I thought just slightly undermined that. You know, I enjoyed it, but never really kind of totally blew me away, you know, and never felt hugely invested in the characters or anything.
The other thing, obviously, with it is it's going to be compared to The Truman Show, which it has, but it's very much, you know, the sort of games version of The Truman Show. And it's just not as smart or doesn't dig as deep as The Truman Show. I mean, to be honest, it's not really trying to, because it is first and foremost a kind of action comedy. And then it's got those themes going on, you know, within it. But if you love The Truman Show, which we all do, and then you watch this, you do feel a little bit dissatisfied with that side of it.
Interesting comparison, because also with The Truman Show, it was kind of Jim Carrey really showing off a completely different side of what he could do. And this is not that. Ryan Reynolds is doing Ryan Reynolds. I mean, I know you shouldn't really complain about films, you know, that aren't even trying to be the thing that you in your mind decide that they should be. I mean, just a little bit of a missed opportunity to just kind of maybe for him to do something different and for them to have done something a little bit kind of cleverer.
It's very much the Ryan Reynolds show, isn't it? And like, it feels like in general at the moment, he's found his kind of brand and he's just Ryan Reynolds now in films, isn't he? Yeah. Kind of, he found that Deadpool thing that worked for him. And so you get that type of humour. There's little sort of fourth wall breaking and things like that in this film. Like, I saw there was like a little ad for his gin company like popped up in the background. And someone you see in the real world, someone has like a Deadpool poster on their wall, you know, and things like that. So it's just very much like he's not even like he tries to sort of disappear into a character or anything anymore. It just feels like an extended Ryan Reynolds skit, you know, and you kind of know if you're going to be up for that or not really, you know, based on your sort of tolerance for Ryan Reynolds. But as Jamie said, I thought Jodie Comer was very good. And I really like Joe Keery as well. He's also one of these kind of programmers in this sort of real world, so to speak. And I thought actually he was quite likable for, you know, a kind of a supporting role. I thought he did a decent job.
Definitely, but I just couldn't get any sense of, like, why are we spending time on this? The stakes were so low in the real world, and then they sort of didn't even really happen anyway. Like, the real world arc didn't particularly make sense, because it was just like, oh, the thing we're really worried about is this collecting evidence for this code, but then it sort of kind of fizzles out, and by the end, the real world stuff resolves in a very different way anyway.
The real world stuff has got a kind of love story as well to it, which we won't give too much away, but there is that going on. But I mean, the game stuff is what it's all about. And that's obviously what people would go to see. You know, when you watch the trailer, that's the focus, all the sort of mad things going on, bank robberies, cars flying, chaos everywhere. I think someone who goes, pays their money and goes to see it on a Friday night, wanting just a big, fun blockbuster, I don't think they'd be disappointed. They're not going to come out like raving about it as if they've just seen Terminator 2 or something. But I think it's absolutely fine. And compared to the crop of blockbusters we've had so far this year, I think it's, you know, a solid entry. You know, there's been worse ones. There's been a couple of better ones. That's what I would sum it up as.
what Matt pointed out, like now I'm thinking about it, is that, yeah, there was something quite nice and like there was a warmth to this one, which kind of like compared to a lot of them feel a little bit more cynical. And I think actually Guy and Buddy's friendship I found really lovely. It kind of held that insignificance that like, oh no, one of the core things in this film is like that these guys are great friends and really there for one another.
Yeah.
There you go then. That's Free Guy, which we're saying is, you know, pretty likeable, if not mind-blowing. And if you want to catch that, that's out in cinemas this Friday. Right, okay, time to go fishing with this.
There are plenty of pretty voices with nothing to say. Do you have something to say?
Oh, sometimes I get a good feeling, yeah.
You're the girl with the deaf family?
Yeah.
I
just want to tell you right now.
And you sing. Interesting.
Something's got a hold on me. So that was CODA. Jamie, what is CODA about?
Well, CODA stands for Children of Deaf Adults, and it is about a girl called Ruby, a teenage girl living in Gloucester, Massachusetts, who's the only hearing person in a family. Basically, her parents, her mum and dad, are both deaf, and her older brother, Leo, is also deaf. And she, like I said, she's a teenager. She goes to high school. She's got all the usual problems. You know, she's being bullied. She's got a good friendship with one friend. There's a guy she kind of fancies from afar. And at home, her home life is very much a sort of hard scrabble existence. That her family are in the fishing business and they're really being squeezed. That all the middlemen in the fishing business are kind of taking all the money, and the actual people out in the trawlers doing the fishing get very, very little. So they're struggling to get by. They've got real money worries. And then the plot really kicks in where this teenager, Ruby, decides she wants to join the school choir. And she joins. She has a typically inspirational teacher who recognizes her talent and wants her to pursue it and go to Berkeley to study music. And that causes all sorts of problems with a family who very much need her at home on the trawlers for safety reasons, because you need someone there who can hear in case there's messages from the coast guards, etc. So if she does go off, it will have a massive impact on the already struggling family. So that's pretty much what it's about.
So did you guys actually like this film? It launched at Sundance, where it sold for, I know every year at Sundance there's a new record, but it sold for a festival record of $25 million to Apple, who are releasing it on the Apple TV Plus streaming service, and it's going to cinemas as well. Yeah, so did you like it? Was it worth that money?
I really liked it. I think the weird thing is that on one level, it's a very by-the-numbers, cliched film that it's got all the usual story beats of this kind of drama. It's got all of the tropes. You know, you can pretty much plot it out from start to finish. Like, for example, like I said, the inspirational teacher, you know, that's a bit of a cliche in a film. There's a montage to I Fought the Law and the Law Won. There's a whole thing of kind of a first love. And when she joins the choir, Ruby has to do a duet with the boy that she kind of fancies, who's in the cool group and kind of knows the girl who's bullying her. So it's that whole thing, will they now, you know, spending time together, will they fall in love, having to rehearse together in their bedroom, etc., etc. So if you look at it cynically like that, it's very much by the numbers, but everything in between those plot points is done so well. The acting's so great. It's got such authenticity to it. You really, really feel you get to know that family and you live with that family and you understand them and their dynamics. It's quite a sort of rambunctious film in some ways, that, you know, there's a lot of arguing and mum and dad really go at it like sort of cat and dog a lot of the time. They're always arguing, but there's a lot of love as well. They have a fantastic sex life, which sort of causes a running joke throughout the film, because they're always embarrassing their daughter because they're always at it. And it's just great. It's a real crowd pleaser. You know, I can see why it sold for that money. I can see why it won awards at Sundance, because you'll go to and come out, you know, punching the air, that it really does it well. It's a crowd pleaser, a heart warmer.
Did you find it to be a crowd pleaser, Layla?
yeah, I watched it in Sundance and I actually kind of came out feeling a bit like meh about it, and like just feeling like, oh, I don't get it. This is so conventional in the middle of all these kind of much more unusual films that I was into more. And I wasn't going to rewatch it actually for this podcast, but I'm so glad that I did, because I liked it a lot more on the second viewing. I'm wondering whether I just kind of had festival fatigue the first time I saw it. The deaf actors in particular for me are so great. And yeah, and just kind of seeing kind of deaf actors who, you know, complicated, super horny, really, really funny actors. You know, I've been a fan of Marlee Matlin's for a while. I loved The Children of a Lesser God. I watched every episode of her season of Celebrity Apprentice, despite Donald Trump. And like actually just seeing her get like a really great role to shine in was fantastic. It's almost a bit like the Free Guy thing, where it was like I was so interested in how they were going to survive, as you know, with their fishing business, and like certain things would be alluded to, like, oh, Marlee Matlin's got like this big group of deaf female friends that she hangs out with, or like how is she going to get on with the other fishermen's wives so they can kind of cooperate together. And then they don't show you those things, and I was like, what do you mean we're back with this quite broad music teacher? And that sort of music line sort of gets two endings. And then sort of a lot of, I felt like the deaf family lines, sort of, it's just like, oh no, don't worry, it all kind of happens off screen almost. And I just like, oh, I just felt like this was just weighted a little bit too wrong. Maybe this is a little bit ungenerous of me, but whether or not this is going to age a little bit like how people talk about The Blind Side, where it's just like, oh, why is it centered around the hearing person? And I mean, I don't know, and I know I'm not deaf. I'd be interested to hear what someone who's deaf thinks about it. Just because I think I've been sitting with it for a while, I have been like asking those questions.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting because actually I watched it for the first time just this week, and I really enjoyed it. I had sort of similar feelings to Jamie, I suppose. And I found that I thought the balance was quite good between, you know, the kind of the singing storyline and the, you know, the fishing storyline and how the family is getting on. And there's obviously the kind of dealings that are going on there, where they're kind of trying to introduce these kind of regulations where people kind of check on what they're doing out there, which costs them a lot of money. So there's kind of, you know, intrigue with that as well. But to me, I felt like it balanced it quite well on that first viewing. But obviously what you say is a very legitimate point, that obviously it does focus on, you know, the hearing character out of the family. For me, that provided quite an interesting angle, because it's such an interesting relationship that the family have been, or, you know, in some ways, or she feels at least, that they're so dependent on her. But then it kind of raises interesting questions of like, you know, well, are they, and would they just get on more if she just wasn't there, you know, and that kind of thing. So I thought that raised some interesting questions for me.
There's one wonderful scene in the film, which is probably a standout scene, where the mother and daughter are having an argument, and the daughter says, like, would you have preferred it if I was born deaf? Which is a big, big question to ask. And then the mother kind of answers it quite honestly as to why she maybe would have preferred it, in terms of, you know, their relationship and their closeness and the difficulties that are thrown up from having, you know, one person in the family who can speak. And, you know, it gets into those matters, which is what I liked about it, that even though, like we said, it does hit a lot of usual plot beats, it's not afraid to sort of, you know, dig into things as well and be a little bit messy and a little bit painful in places as well. So I thought on the whole, the balance was pretty good.
I mean, I would say on the whole, it's a lovely film and I would recommend people watching it. It's just, I suppose it's one of those things that it's just watching it twice over different times, and watching Sound of Metal in between. And then I've been reading some stuff all about Millicent Simmons and like deaf representation. I think I might have kind of overthought it a little bit, because actually when I returned to the film and watched it again, I was just like, oh, this is lovely. And Emilia Jones is an amazing future star.
The fact that
she's English and she's singing and she's doing sign language and she's doing an accent at the same time.
Did you know she's the daughter of Alice Jones as well? As in the walking in the air guy.
No, I didn't know that.
Apparently she wasn't a singer really before this, which I sort of find hard to believe in a way, because she's got such an amazing voice.
Wow. I thought she was incredibly likable, a real winning presence. And like Layla said, it's just so great to see Marlee Matlin get a great role again. But she won her Oscar for Children of a Lesser God when she was 21 years old, unbelievably. You know, that was 1987, so she's done a lot of stuff since then. But this is a really, really good role and a great performance. And I think they're all great in it. You know, the whole cast are wonderful.
I would say that Eugenio Derbez is not wonderful. maybe because we've just had so many great angry music teachers, haven't we? Like, we had J.K. Simmons and Whoopi Goldberg and Sister Act 2, Jack Black.
Yeah, it's very...
It's actually a difficult tier to get to be a great, you know, music teacher in film. I don't think he's quite at that level.
Maybe wonderful's too strong for him. I was more talking about the family. But I do think that kind of role, the sort of inspirational music teacher that we've seen a million times before, yes, it is a cliche, but I did have fun spending time with him. You know, that he's just a really colourful, larger-than-life character. And every time he comes in the room, you know, you kind of know about it. And it was just part of the entertainment value for me.
Yeah, maybe I was just in a very charitable mood when I watched it. I watched one more depressing film that we're going to talk about in a minute the night before. Then I watched this, so maybe I was just grateful to have a more uplifting kind of film. But I laughed at, you know, some of his moments.
Yeah, I'd not seen him in much before aside from Overboard.
He was in the terrible Overboard remake.
Might have had residual resentment.
But this was more of a redemption moment for me after that. Okay, that is Coda. And so if you want to see that, that's out in cinemas and also on Apple TV Plus from Friday. It's time now for an alternative line reading where we kind of say a film quote in a weird accent and see if people can actually guess it out of context. And it's fallen on me today to do it. So I'm not very good at accents, so I'm going to attempt to do this in the style of Peter Lorre. So can you guys guess what film this is? What is the most resilient parasite? Bacteria? A virus? An intestinal worm? An idea. Can you guess the film?
No.
I was going to say, to give you... by the accent.
To give you a clue, obviously this will probably help Jamie more than Layla, but as Jane often says when she does this, think about the player, you know, think about what sort of film I might go for.
In that case, it's got to be either a Christopher Nolan film or an Ethan Hawke film or a Richard Linklater film, because they're your heroes.
That sounds more Nolan to me.
Yeah, is it Inception?
It's Inception, well done. Yes.
There you go.
Yes, that's Don Cobb in Inception when he's kind of selling the idea to Ken Watanabe at the beginning of the film, Inside His Dream.
What is the most resilient parasite? Bacteria? A virus? An intestinal worm?
What Mr. Cobb is trying to say?
An idea. Resilient, highly contagious. Once an idea has taken hold in the brain, it's almost impossible to eradicate. An idea that is fully formed, fully understood, that sticks right in there somewhere.
You're in the wrong career, Matt. I think that's, that accent was really something.
Another one of those, same time next week. So on to the next film. And if you are feeling comfortable, let's change that with this.
Oye, ¿qué haces?
Hey, hey. Por favor, baja el arma. Ok, llévate lo que quieras, mira. Aquí está. Pero por favor.
So that was New Order. Layla, tell us about New Order.
So New Order is kind of starts at the wedding of an incredibly wealthy Mexican family. We've got Marianne, a young, beautiful, blonde Mexican woman. She's getting married to another affluent guy called Alan. And everything is going very well. And the party looks beautiful. And they've got this gorgeous home. And then a former employee of theirs shows up at the door and says that, you know, there's been these terrible protests that have shut down various hospitals and stuff. And now I have to take my wife, who also worked for them for many years, to a private hospital because she needs to have a heart operation or she'll die. And I need, you know, I can't remember how much it was in pesos, but I did Google it. It's about £7,000.
Yeah, I did the same. Converted it on Google as well.
Yeah, so kind of like a lot of money, but, you know, not to these guys, because you've just come from this amazing event and you can see that, you know, they probably spent that just on like the canapes and the champagne and cocaine and, you know, gorgeous furniture everywhere. So the young bride is much more sympathetic than some of the rest of the family, who give him a little bit of money but not the whole thing and want him to go away. And she decides to take it upon herself to leave her wedding and try and help out this woman who, I think it seems, they don't specify, but maybe was like a nanny to her, but someone that she cares about very much. And it's sort of at that moment that sort of society collapses. People storm the wedding. Marianne is, her car is attacked and a sort of revolution happens, kind of a bloody coup. So I think it's not incompetently made. Some of the acting is very good. You know, it's shot quite handsomely. Some of the editing is quite good at, like, you know, ramping up some tension. Just as a story, I just thought it was completely narratively empty. It like sets up a few interesting ideas, like it might have a bit of Parasite about it, or it might have, you know, oh, what we might do is explore these ideas of like, oh, actually, when there's a revolution, it just kind of keeps the old guard in power in a different way. You know, like there's some things it touches on, but it doesn't really do any of that. And I just found myself feeling a bit like this director, who is a very controversial person in Mexico, was a bit like the sort of cult from the film Martyrs, where they had this idea in that film, which is a film I quite like. I'm not talking about that film. I'm talking about the cult within it, where what we're going to do is we're just going to torture someone. And that's eventually going to make something kind of transcendent and profound. And that's what this film was doing. It was just like, we're just going to get more brutal and nastier. As that went on, I just felt as like, oh, this is just more and more empty. I think this film is just like, and the word I kept coming back to is this film is disgusting. I actually think it's morally bankrupt and it didn't have any ideas. I just felt like it was a bit like some sort of like right-wing 4chan thing about like, we're going to own the libs, where you've got this like nice young woman who thinks that she wants to kind of be charitable and help people than her, and we'll show her for being so idiotic, because actually the poor underclass in this society are just all kind of essentially just like sadistic serial killers. And you, for trying to help them, are actually doing a very, very foolish thing, and we're going to delight in torturing you. I hated it. And like, I just think there's, I have so many thoughts. And I think there is such a thing about like, oh, you know, people nowadays, they're like too offended by stuff. And I wouldn't even say that I was particularly offended, because like, I can like stuff that is offensive. I have publicly defended the film Cannibal Holocaust on more than one occasion, but this was also empty and grotesque and just nihilistic and horrible. And, you know, a lot of the time with my film reviews at the end, I kind of feel like, oh, well, at least they tried to make a film. I think everyone involved with this should be ashamed of themselves.
strong words there. I do largely agree with what you said, to be honest, but I really kind of quite liked the first sort of act, where you kind of, yeah, you're at this very wealthy, opulent sort of wedding, and you know, you see this unrest building, and I thought it was quite kind of tense when it first began, like that the first kind of, you know, 20 minutes or so, and I was kind of quite pulled into it. But then, yeah, like as it kind of went on, there was just something sort of like sadistic about it, but without any kind of discernible point being made. Like it was just sort of a bit too sort of punishingly brutal, with just, to me, no real worthwhile point to it. But Jamie, did you feel differently?
I kind of agree with you. I mean, filmmaking wise, I enjoyed it, in that I thought it was well put together, and it really reminded me of Michael Haneke, that it's very cool and clinical and unflinching. The things you've said, I do also agree with, but I think the key word here that Layla used is nihilistic, but I don't necessarily agree that it's got no ideas to it whatsoever. But I think all of it is wrapped up in nihilism, that you're sort of watching this revolution from the perspective of the 1%, from the wealthy, but it's kind of looking at the underclasses rising up. And, you know, it's very much shot from the perspective of the 1% of the fear of that and how horrendous it would be. And when you have these people rise up, the big idea of a movie seems to be, well, the people who were rulers before are terrible and self-centered and don't care about anyone but themselves. But then the people, when they rise up, are even worse and they're brutal. Again, they're all about money and sort of making, taking advantage of the situation. That, to me, did leave a sort of nasty taste in my mouth that the only person you care about, the only person who's got any humanity to them, is the lead character, the one who leaves her wedding to go and help. And then she, you know, don't want to give too much away, but she isn't treated, doesn't get off any better than anyone else, which sort of left a really nasty, nasty taste in my mouth. So yeah, I can definitely see why it's caused a lot of offence. I mean, some people absolutely love it and think it's great, and a lot of people absolutely loathe it. But I do think the one thing you can say about it is it will certainly get discussions going. You know, I think it's already caused... There was a massive backlash on Twitter, like in Mexico, when just the trailer launched, that people were, you know, really saying, oh, this looks disgraceful, that, you know, it looks like, you know, it's racist, that it's saying that all of the people of colour are the underclasses, you know, and it caused a big backlash, and you can see why it's done that. But at the same time, there's a feeling in the world at the moment, isn't there, which this is trying to tap into. There's a feeling all across the globe of people who are, they've had enough and they're angry, and there's a lot of rage going on, and this film is trying to tap into that. Whether it does it well or not is another matter. But Variety said in their review, which I really like this line, but they said that this film picks up where the Joker left off, which I thought was really nice and clever way of putting it. So you kind of know what you're in for, but it's a tough ride. It's a really, really tough ride. The last sort of 20 minutes, it's like torture, rape, all done with a sort of unblinking gaze. So you've got to steel yourself for it, put it that way.
I just felt like it was making the point with that act of this, like the people that then when they get power are far, far worse.
Yeah.
And so the people at the beginning who were treating them poorly were correct to do so. If anything, they should have been more horrible to them. Because we have this, I mean, I don't think that this is a big spoiler to say. So we have this kind of, you know, young idealistic bride going off to try and help her maid. And then 2 minutes later, we've got another maid coming in, gleefully killing people and like filling up designer handbags with swag. And it's just like, oh, that's the point that the film is making, that like caring about people or trying to help them is stupid.
It's interesting you mentioned her as well, because that was something that you reminded me, that really sort of clanged for me when you saw her, just the way she was, yeah, almost like cartoonishly, like, you know, bagging up jewels and things. Even if, you know, whatever reason, we're being opportunistic in that moment, you wouldn't do it with such kind of glee, I don't think, in such a horrible situation. So that for me almost was the first moment where I sort of think, oh, maybe I'm not going to enjoy this film, you know.
Yeah, I'm not someone that like just like, I love Michael Haneke, I love Lars von Trier, all of that, but this just had kind of a black heart and just a lack of ideas. I don't feel like shock easy, but I was like shocked by how appalled I was by it.
What we were saying about the underclasses, you know, turn out to be worse than the people they're replacing. You get the sense at the wedding at the start that the people in charge, the wealthy people, are all sort of morally bankrupt, and all they care about is money, and there's a lot of back scratching going on and sort of looking after each other and nepotism, that, you know, you get the sense that in business there's bribery going on, and they all give packets of cash as their wedding gifts. They've been downtrodden by these horrible self-regarding people, but when they then come into power, they're just far, far worse, that they're just actively, you know, torturing people, punishing people, killing people. It's back to that word nihilism. It just feels completely soulless.
Yeah, I think it's kind of the opposite of what Bong Joon-ho did with Parasite, where he actually had that dynamic, but I think he had a lot of balance with both sides. Like, the wealthier people weren't monsters. Nobody in Parasite's a monster. Well, maybe one guy. You know what I mean? Like, it's like if you took Parasite and you took out 80% of the genius of it, and then you took away all of the human empathy as well. I think that's how you know this.
And just ramped up the violence as well.
Yeah. I think we've kind of evolved past using sexual violence in quite this way. I mean, I don't even want to repeat what happens in case there's younger listeners, but like there is just some gleeful pushing to the extremes when it comes to that. And I think, yeah, sure, you can kind of have sexual violence in films if you're kind of making an interesting point, but like it's just for its own sake.
Mm.
I thought.
Obviously, not exactly an easy film to recommend. If you do fancy giving it a whirl, New Order is out in cinemas from Friday. Time now for a quick intermission with A Plain Talking, where we kind of try and explain a sort of filmy term that you might end up reading in a review or something. And this week it's Dutch tilt. So does anybody want to take on Dutch tilt and tell us what this means?
I mean, my understanding of a Dutch tilt is that it's the camera angle that, like, when you put something askew, like there's a lot of it in The Third Man when they're sort of doing the chases through the sewers and stuff, that you have these tilted angles, which, you know, harks back to German expressionism, and they use deep shadows and strange angles and sort of contorted everything, and it's all to reflect the character's tortured mindset.
Yeah, I think you've pretty much nailed that there. And interesting as well, this fact I learned from Wikipedia is, you said German expressionism, and it's the Dutch is believed to be a mistake on the word Deutsch.
Ah.
So, you know, there you go.
Because it's normally a reaction shot, isn't it? Like, it's because something terrible has happened that's made someone really feel shocked or insane. Am I thinking of the right thing? I'm thinking the bit in Jaws where just after the shark puts its face out and it kind of goes to Chief Brody at like this very strange angle, and he kind of jerks back with the cigarette in his mouth. I've seen that film too many times.
I think it is used like that, but it's also used just as a general, you know, when you're just framing action. Like I said, in Third Man, when he's running down the sewers and running down alleyways, and it's big, deep shadows and sort of long shadows, and then all the angles are strange and they're tilted, and it's just to reflect that, you know, that everything is in disharmony, really, in the character's mind and in the world.
There you go. And now we'll move on, time for our final film of the week, a sort of a true tale of espionage with this.
Sounds like work.
No, tell them I'm in my chair.
Yes, he's just walked in.
This is unexpected. I can't believe I'm actually having lunch with spies. I'm just a salesman.
Exactly. You're civilians. The KGB won't be watching.
It would be a real service to Great Britain.
What would you want me to do?
That was The Courier. Jamie, can you set up The Courier for us, please?
So The Courier is set in the early 60s when the Cold War is kind of really getting scary with the Cuban Missile Crisis. There's the whole thing, you know, nuclear war is very much hanging over the world. So it's really an espionage story. It's based on a true story, and it's about a military colonel called Oleg Penkovsky who came forward, and he essentially wanted to leak information from the Soviet Union in order to ward off World War III. MI6 and the CIA obviously wanted to get this information, but were very worried about how they can get it. But if they sent someone in the intelligence agency into Moscow, then obviously the Soviets would probably guess that. They hit upon the idea that they were using an ordinary businessman who often trades in Europe and who can trade in Moscow without raising any eyebrows. And they pick upon Greville Wynne, who's played by Benedict Cumberbatch. And they essentially ask him to start going to Moscow, meeting up with Oleg Penkovsky as if it's sort of normal business dealings. And he has to kind of get the information and sneak it back, act as a courier, as it were, and get it back to the West so they know what's really going on and, you know, can try and stop nuclear war happening.
Did you actually like the film?
It's kind of one of those, it's a strange word to use, comforting, because it's about, you know, the imminent end of the world. But from a movie going sense, it's quite comforting because it's a good old traditional spy movie, a Cold War thriller, espionage. And it's a usual thing, you know, lots of suspenseful situations, guys meeting, you know, whispering to each other, trying to get the information back. The constant threat over their heads that if they're discovered, you know, then they would go to prison or worse. So it's quite suspenseful, and I thought it was well made. It's very handsome to look at. Benedict Cumberbatch, I thought it's the kind of role that really suits him, that he's very good at. So I found it, you know, enjoyable without ever being, you know, something special or leaping out of those tram lines. You kind of know what to expect. And I thought it was a good, solid three-star movie, just to be reductive about it.
How did you find it, Layla?
Oh, I'd give it 3.5 stars. Yeah, no, I liked it. But, I mean, I think you're exactly right with the comfort thing, because I do like this type of film. I love a Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, Bridge of Spies sort of thing. Yeah, I was pretty up for it. I do think Benedict Cumberbatch is just perfect in this, because I think it's quite hard to be someone who's an interesting character that you're with, but also convincingly someone that people don't really notice. And I think he manages to do that really well. Generally, I think the acting in this is very, very strong. Jessie Buckley, I think, is just like really phenomenal in absolutely everything that she does. But I really liked the chemistry between the two men, and like I really kind of bought their journey from kind of meeting to the point where they kind of a codependency, I guess, and like kind of almost like viewing each other as like brothers by the final act. I liked that we sort of kept focus on them. We didn't kind of go into too much of like the actual in and outs of what was going to happening with the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was actually still always at its core about these two men and their relationship. So before this podcast, I don't think I'd really heard that much about this, which I was quite surprised by, because I think it is a decent film that I think a lot of people would enjoy, but it doesn't seem to be getting a huge promotional boost.
It's been kind of delayed a couple of times, which just doesn't really help, does it? Especially for like a sort of a smaller scale film like this. And it kind of does maybe feels like it could be something that's like, it could feel like it could be a quality TV drama perhaps as well. Cumberbatch obviously elevates it, and Jessie Buckley as well. And Rachel Brosnahan is like a kind of CIA officer in the film who he deals with. She's also very enjoyable in it. But yeah, I found that, again, similarly, just it was this kind of solidly enjoyable, you know, nothing to kind of write home about. But I think there will be a lot of people that would like it. You know, it's sort of, I feel like this is sort of damning with faint praise, but it's that kind of film that I'd recommend to my parents to watch, because I'm just sure they would enjoy it, you know, and get a lot out of it. Like you say, very, very Bridge of Spies in a lot of ways. Like, I really liked the relationship between the two of them. I almost thought it verged on a sort of love story between the two of them at points. I wondered if it was going to almost go in a different direction occasionally. But yeah, solid, old-fashioned, you know, nuts and bolts kind of storytelling that sort of works well. You know, didn't quite go in the way I expected in sort of a way that was quite interesting. You know, it wasn't quite, you know, exactly the film I was expecting.
Without going into spoilers, it does in the final third go in a direction I didn't expect and almost becomes a different film. I mean, Cumberbatch is fantastic in the final scenes, and I really want to say more about it, but I can't without spoiling anything. But yeah, it does sort of have a few surprises there. But I do agree as well with the friendship. I think this is very much a film about two guys on different sides of the fence who come together and really learn empathy for each other, and that sort of gives this film a heart as well. From that perspective as well, it's maybe a little bit different to the usual spy thriller, but good solid drama. You don't need to recommend it to your parents, Matt, because I've already recommended it to them. So just to let you know. No, I'm just trying to be funny, don't worry. Apparently there was quite a lot of controversy over this story, how much is true and how much is not. The guy, Greville Wynne, actually released an autobiography about it. And then a lot of people sort of picked it apart and said no, that couldn't have happened and that didn't happen because of this, and said it was utter nonsense. So there's that side of it as well, which is maybe why it's not a better known story. Like I didn't know anything about it until I saw this film, but I think they've kind of pieced it together from various sources and done the best they can. But there's definitely going to be a little bit of artistic license taken here and there as well.
Well, I mean, I think they do, maybe for legal reasons, it is based on real events, not on a true story.
Yeah,
I'm not sure what the distinction clever. Is.
If that sounds like it's up your street, then Courier is in cinemas from Friday as well. So to finish, we've just got time for a reader's question. And this ties quite well, because we're talking about June earlier, obviously. And the question is, what is the best book to movie adaptation?
I mean, I would always say that probably the best adaptation has to be something that starts as quite a bad book and ends up as a great film. Mm. And that for me is the trio of The Exorcist, The Godfather and Jaws, which are all pretty mediocre books, but amazing films.
Nice. How about you, Jamie?
First of all, I can't let that go without saying I think The Exorcist is quite a good book. But I agree.
It's one of the greatest films, and I would just say it's a...
Oh, it is. Yeah. No, it is. But I agree wholeheartedly with Jaws and Godfather. Rather ropey books. But I came at it from a slightly different angle, that I was going more great books to great films that they kind of are really special in both mediums. So I came up with a little list I'm going to bore you with my overall winner. Ones that really sort of I immediately came to mind that I love are To Kill a Mockingbird, LA Confidential, Big Sleep and Long Goodbye, based on Raymond Chandler. The Long Goodbye one, Robert Altman, 1973, I love because he really turns the story inside out and sort of sets it in the 70s, sort of hippies and all of that. Totally reinvents it, but it works brilliantly. Lord of the Rings is an obvious one. I think they did a fantastic adaptation there. Fight Club, Age of Innocence, Edith Wharton, Martin Scorsese. Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which we mentioned earlier. Again, fantastic. Yeah. Silence of the Lambs. I'll stop there because I could go on for a while. But my overall winner, and it's a very personal choice for me, is Stand By Me, my favourite film of all time. So it probably won't surprise you that I'm banging on about it again. But based on the novella The Body by Stephen King, which is part of a Different Seasons collection, which also has the Shawshank Redemption and At Pupil novellas in it. Fantastic read. And the novella is one of King's strongest works. It's very, very personal, based very much on his own childhood, a lot of the anecdotes in it. And it's almost like if you imagine It on a smaller scale, but it has that same thing as the children sequences in the book It, set in the 50s, that, you know, it's so colourful and the characters are so lovable and it's just wonderful. And it's a wonderful, wonderful novella. And then Rob Reiner took it and turned it into this incredible film. And I think he was really clever that he took the character of Gordy and moved him to the front of a story, because in a novella, it's more sort of evenly about the four of the boys. And if there's a leader, it's River Phoenix's character, Chris Chambers. But he made it about Gordy and about this sensitive, lost little boy kind of finding himself, which was a wonderful move. And again, a very personal thing for Reiner to do, because he saw himself in Gordy. So I think it really works. But yeah, highly recommend film and the novella if you haven't read or seen them.
I'm going to go somewhere in between you guys for my choice. And this is going to annoy Jamie, but it's not a book I consider terrible, but just a book I consider was, you know, fine, but then vastly improved upon, would be The Shining, also sticking with the Stephen King theme. Because to me, the book is just, it's just fine. I find it just a bit boring, not particularly scary. Whereas I think the film just, it adds so much ambiguity that just makes it so much more interesting to me. And oh, I think he kind of, you know, took a solid kind of, you know, idea from the book and just ran with it and just nailed the film version.
I just say the opposite for me. I so rather prefer the book than the film. Oh my God, miles. Yeah. I actually think the book is way more complicated and interesting than the film. But I don't hate the film. I just love the book.
Which one did you come to first?
The film.
Interesting. Me too.
I think The Shining's a masterpiece as a book.
Just for the listeners to this podcast, while Matt was saying all of that about The Shining and the film being so much better than the book, Layla and I were kind of...
rolling our eyes.
Shaking our heads, rolling eyes. And I actually came to the book first, and I think the book is one of the greatest horror novels and is a masterpiece and is a lot more complex than the film. I agree with Layla there, and has a lot more heart than the film. That it's about a guy whose tragic flaw is that he's an alcoholic, and it's sort of the hotel uses that to break him down and turn him against his family into this abusive, horrible husband and father. But I also think the film is outstanding and is very, very different. You have to take it on its own terms, which took me many years to do. but for many years, because I'm a big King fan and I read the book first, I sort of had a bit of a problem with Kubrick's Shining. But over the years, I've kind of come to appreciate it on its own merits and its own brilliance. So I think that's also a masterpiece as well. So there you go. But if I had to pick one, it's a book.
Yeah, so I would say that I think it's that there's a really interesting thing with both the book and the film where it's like two artists kind of saying what their biggest flaws are. Like Stephen King's written this book and it's all about like his alcoholism and, you know, him as a writer and him as a neglectful father and the problems he had, because he didn't actually stop drinking until a few years after he wrote The Shining, amazingly. Mm. In the film, a lot of it's about like Stanley Kubrick admitting what a terrible director he is, like not as a in terms of what he makes, but in the way that he treats his actors. Yeah. And I always think of that scene where Jack's writing the line time and time and time again, and how I feel like that is Stanley Kubrick confessing to the way that he is torturing Shelley Duvall by making her do scenes sometimes hundreds of times in a row. I mean, I like both, but The Shining, the book for me, is like one of my favourite books of all time.
I mean, they're completely different artists. That King is quite sentimental and has a big heart, and Kubrick obviously is visionary but quite sort of cold and intellectual, and you can see that in both versions. And I always remember the bit Stephen King bangs, because he of course hates the film, but he bangs on about this, that one night in the middle of the night Stephen King was asleep about 2 a.m. or something, and the phone went and he picked it up and it was Stanley Kubrick, and Kubrick just said, "Do you believe in God?" That's all he said, and Stephen King sort of forced about it and said, "Yes, I do," and Kubrick said, "I don't," and put the phone down, and that was it. And that kind of sums up the difference to me.
That's exactly what Jack Nicholson in The Shining would do to someone. But I think, you know, it's just in the book, it's an arc. He doesn't want to kill his family at the beginning. And Jack Nicholson arrives ready for murder.
Yeah, from that opening hotel interview where he's mad as a hatter right from the start with his eyebrows racing over his back of his head. Yeah.
Oh, Matt, you must really regret bringing this up.
Well, I'm glad I ended it on a talking point. On that note, obviously, let us know if you have any favoured book to film adaptations or which you prefer out of The Shining book and film, of course, as well. But sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. So until the next one, it's just time for us to all say bye.
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 Here's Johnny.